outdoors was becoming familiar to him, less alarming. He had been on a bus, and to the amusement of the other passengers expressed his amazement at the magnitude of the fare. Returning, he had tried the tube, and the tunnels hadn't bothered him, or the crowds. For days he had concentrated on getting used to London, to losing the terrible self-consciousness that had made him feel everyone was looking at him and everyone knew. Walking along Acton High Street, he followed a girl part of the way. That is, she was walking along and he was walking behind her, going in the same direction. She wore spiky heels and a short skirt, which made him feel uncomfortable. He wouldn't express it to himself more strongly than that. It made him feel uncomfortable, that was all. Suppose it had been night time, though, and one of the paths crossing Ealing Common, rather than this densely populated place, what then? He refused to answer the question. The shop where they bought furniture and cleared flats was at the bottom of Grove Road. On the pavement outside was a rack of old books no one would buy, either for their content or their decoration value, and just inside the window a tray of Victorian jewellery, rings and pendants and buttons. The stuff for sale inside reminded him of Muriel's own furniture, big, ugly, uncomfortable and shabby. A stuffed peacock, with its tail feathers spread in a threadbare fan perched on the back of a chaise longue upholstered in horsehair and black leather. A boy of about 18 in jeans and a denim jerkin came out and asked Victor if he could help him, or did he just want to browse round. Victor said he had some furniture he wanted to sell. It was really a valuation he wanted. "You'd have to see Mr. Jupp," the boy said. "Oh, all right. Yeah, but he's not here, is he? He's up the other shop. I mean, you could go up there if you felt like it, or I could pass on a message." "Yeah, I could go if it isn't far. Salisbury Road, well, sort of Kilburn. You want to go to Queen's Park on the Bakerloo?" Victor didn't realise until he got there and saw the name Harvest Road. Everything seemed to be spelt wrong around here, or spelled in an unlikely, perverse way that made him feel uneasy or as if mocked. But it wasn't that which caused him to pause outside the station, lean against the wall, and momentarily close his eyes. Solent Gardens was a turning off Harvest Road. A step or two or three westwards, and you were in Kensal Rise. He had told Muriel he wanted to forget, to put the past behind him, but he was walking along Harvest Road in the opposite direction to where Jupp's shop was, and remembering how, 10 years before, with Sidney's gun in his pocket, he had been in the park that lay to the right here very early in the morning. In those days, he'd got into the habit of roaming London at all hours. Possessing the gun gave him confidence. With the Luger in his pocket, he felt invincible, a victor indeed. Had Sidney, home again by then, ever missed it? Had Muriel been told? If they had, no hint of this filtered through to Victor, living up in Finchley in his studio flat, driving cars for Alan to airports and stations. In the mornings he would sometimes get up at 5 and go out while it was still dark. His hours were strange and irregular anyway, meeting planes as he often did at 6 in the morning, taking home to Surrey or Kent partygoers who at midnight or later drunk too much to drive themselves. That morning in the late autumn, he'd been on his way to Heathrow, due there at 9:30 to meet, in the best of the limousines, an Arab businessman, and take him to the London Hilton. What had happened to the limousine? Victor had sometimes wondered since. Leaving home at 5, he had parked it round the back here in Milman Road, and then he had walked about, feeling an excitement rise in him that he couldn't have called pleasant, but which he needed to have, the trembling, breathless, choking feeling Cal had told him he felt when he looked at a pornographic photo. Cal hadn't used those words, but that was what he meant, and Victor had recognised this as the feeling he had when he contemplated forcing some woman, any woman. At 7:30 he had entered the park that lay to the north of Harvest Road. The girl was exercising a dog, a very small dog. She had just taken it off the lead and watched it run into the bushes when Victor seized hold of her. He caught her from behind, hooking one arm round her neck and clamping his hand across her mouth. That was to stop her crying out. She hadn't needed to make a sound because she was seen. A man had been in among the trees, having stepped in there for natural purposes, they said at the trial, which meant standing up against a bush for a pee. That was just Victor's ill luck. He didn't forget the gun, but he didn't use it. He ran. He hadn't been certain whether both of them chased him or just the man, but it came out at the trial that it was both, and two or three others they picked up along the way, like a pack of hounds after a miserable fox. Round those back streets he had run, doubling back and hiding, still thinking then about shaking them off and finding the car and getting off to Heathrow, still hoping. He had found himself in that lane between back gardens, a place of broken concrete pavings and garage entrances and padlocked gates. One gate wasn't padlocked, though, and he had gone in, up the path, bent double so they shouldn't see him over the fence, ducking down at last into a corner made by house wall and fence. It was then that he had heard the throb of a taxi's diesel engine and a front door slam. The occupants of the house were leaving it, were going out. If they were going out at this time of the morning, he had reasoned, it would be for the day. He climbed up onto the extension roof and in through a bathroom window that had been left open a crack at the top. It was a sash window with nothing to hold it, and it had slid down easily. By then his pursuers were lost, or at least were soundless and invisible. He crouched for some minutes on that bathroom floor. Then, because he was sure the house was empty, he went out onto the landing. He crossed the landing and looked through a crack of a barely open door. And because he could see nothing, or not enough, he pushed the door a little, and the girl in bed inside. The girl called Rosemary Stanley sat up and screamed at the sight of him, jumped up, screaming, and ran to the window, smashed it with a hairbrush and screamed, "Help me! Help me!" to the outside world. Strange thing was that the house meant nothing to him as he looked at it now. No doubt it was the same house, 62 Solent Gardens, the end of a terrace. But he would not have recognised it on sight alone. He walked along the opposite side of the street, looking at it. The uneven plaster surface had been painted chalk white, and the front door was a different colour, wasn't it? Victor couldn't remember whether he'd ever seen the front door. The broken window had been mended. Oh, of course it had, years ago. Yet, somehow, when he had thought about that house while in prison, he'd always seen it with the window broken and the wind blowing in and lifting the curtains. That had been one of the most frightening things, that billowing curtain, for each time it lifted, he had expected to see a policeman on a ladder outside. And then at last, he had seen one. He would never know why he had aimed the gun at Fleetwood and not at the policeman on the ladder outside the window. A woman came out and walked to the gate and leaned over it, looking to the right and then to the left. She was about 40, dark and plump, and there was no way she could be either Rosemary Stanley or Rosemary Stanley's mother. The Stanleys must have moved away. She went back into the house, leaving the door a little ajar. Victor turned round and walked back past the house towards Harvest Road and Salisbury Road and Jupp's shop. In that room with the girl, it had all seemed unreal. "This can't be happening," was what he'd thought over and over again. The police had insisted he meant to rape the girl, but this had never crossed his mind. Indignation was what he had felt. Indignation and amazement that all this could have happened. The police outside and police trying to get in. A state of siege, in fact. Sirens sounding, a crowd gathered and watching. And all because he put his arm around a girl's neck and run away and tried to find refuge in an empty house. Jupp's shop looked exactly like the one in Acton. There was a trough full of second-hand books out on the pavement and a tray of Victorian jewellery just inside the window. A bell jangled when he opened the door. Inside it was different, with less furniture and a case of pin-stuck butterflies, clouded yellows and commas and red admirals, instead of the stuffed peacock. On a red marble table stood an ancient cash register priced at £34. Victor couldn't imagine why anyone would want to buy it. A dusty green velvet curtain at the back of the shop was pulled aside and an old man came out. He was tall and strong-looking, with big calloused hands. His face was the purplish-red of Morocco leather, against which his mass of creamy white hair, worn rather long, and the yellowish-white shaggy moustache made an almost violent contrast. He had little, bright, red-veined blue eyes. "Are you Mr. Jupp?" said Victor. The old man nodded. He was one of those people who always stick out their lower lips when they nod. For his age, he was extraordinarily dressed in a pair of denim jeans, a red shirt, and a black pinstriped waistcoat, which he wore unbuttoned. Victor explained what he wanted, that he had a house full of furniture to be valued and a buyer found for the items. "Well, I could come and have a shofty," said Jupp. "Where is it?" Not out in the sticks, I hope. Victor said it was stored in the garage of a house in Gunnersbury. The lower lip went out over the upper as Jupp nodded. So long as you don't get things out of proportion, he said. I mean, no delusions of grandeur about Mum's priceless antiques and all that jazz.
How did you know it was my mother's? Said Victor.
Well, ask yourself, Cocky. Who else would it be? Poor old Mum's gone at last and left you her bits, which is the last thing you want to be lumbered with, them not being your Louis Kangs and your Epplewhite, whatever you might wish others to believe.
It is good furniture, Victor protested, beginning to feel aggrieved.
Oh, yeah, I dare say. As long as we don't have to hear about valuations and finding a buyer. What I do is clear flats and houses, right? I have a shifty, tell you the price, and if you like it, I'll clear the lot. If you don't, you go elsewhere and find a bigger sucker than what I am, if you can. Right? You happy with that?
Okay, but, I mean, I'll have to warn her you're coming. My aunt, I mean. It's my aunt's place, where it is. I'll have to go round and tell her you're coming.
Well, don't break no speed records, said Jupp. It'll be a good fortnight. I'm up to my eyebrows for the next fortnight. How about we say 2 weeks tomorrow, Cocky? Eh? You give me the good lady's address and I'll be there 3 on the dot.
Victor gave him Muriel's address. Jupp wrote it down and Victor's own name as well. Victor waited for the name to be recognised, but it seemed to mean nothing to Jupp, who closed up his order book, took a packet of Polar mints out of his pocket and offered one to Victor. Not liking to refuse, Victor took a mint. Jupp hesitated reflectively, contemplating the mint on the top of the pack, rather as a man who is trying to give up smoking stares with longing and disgust and doubt and hunger at the next cigarette. After a second or two, he gave a small sigh, folded the torn paper over the exposed mint and restored the pack to his pocket.
Well, mustn't indulge myself, he said. Well, I used to be addicted to these things. Something shocking. Hooked, you'd say. 20 packets a day was nothing to me, and 30 was more like it. Luckily, I haven't got my own teeth, or they'd have gone for a Burton. Nowadays, I've got down to 5. A steady 5, and I'm happy. Well, let's say I can take it. I can live with it. I don't suppose you can understand that, Cocky.
Although he had never been subject to an addiction, Victor could understand it only too well. It made him feel uncomfortable, and in a way he wished he hadn't come to Jupp. But he didn't want to have to go searching for another second-hand furniture dealer, so he said he'd see Jupp at Muriel's on Thursday fortnight at 3 in the afternoon. This time he avoided the tube and got onto a bus instead. Going over the hump of bridge by Kensal Rise Station, he caught sight from the window of a newsagent's board on which was scrawled, Acton Girl in Rape Horror. He turned his head sharply away. But at the next stop, he got off the bus, went into the first newsagent's he came to, and bought a paper, The Standard. Chapter 5. The story was a short one, at the foot of the page. A girl from Acton Vale had been raped in Gunnersbury Park on the previous evening, her jaw broken by blows, her face cut. A gardener found her after she had lain all night where her attacker had flung her in a shrubbery of laurels. Reading it gave Victor a strange feeling, a faint dizziness, a nausea. In the past, he had sometimes read accounts of rapes he himself had committed during his marauding of London from Finchley to Chiswick and from Harsden to Leytonstone. One of Alan's cars parked somewhere as, en route to fetch a client, he looked for what the more sensational papers called his prey. In those days, the police and judges and juries and the general public had been far less sympathetic towards rape victims and were far less condemnatory of rapists than they now were. The consensus of opinion had been that the victims asked for all they got and that the rapists were tempted beyond control. High-ranking police officers were not above suggesting that victims should lie back and enjoy it. It seemed to Victor, reading The Standard, that things had changed a lot. This had registered with him, even while he was still in prison, that what with Women's Lib and women campaigning against the way rape victims were treated and the attitude of the court changing, rape was regarded with a severity unthinkable 10 years ago. Here, on an inside page, were some figures. He read them as he walked along. Out of 1,334 cases of rape, 644 men had been proceeded against. A variety of sentences had been imposed on those found guilty. 12 of the men had been given life imprisonment, 11 of them 7 to 10 years imprisonment, and 56 had been given 2 to 3 years. It was interesting, he thought, that in only 3 cases had a restriction order been made under the Mental Health Act, yet
Speaking for himself, personally, he knew that the acts of rape he had performed had been beyond his control, had had nothing to do with will, had been as involuntary and as distinct from any decision or purpose of his own as his firing the gun at Fleetwood. Did that mean he was mad when he did these things, or at least not responsible for his actions? Having now walked all the way down Ladbroke Grove, reading his paper and just staring at the blurring print, thinking, wondering how in the future he would control that which admitted no control, Victor got on a bus that would take him home. A faint feeling of regret for the prison he had left took hold of him, a certain nostalgia for that brutish sloth and lack of any responsibility. He had been looked after in there, and safe, and if it had often been uncomfortable, always boring, a waste of life, there had been no worries, and later on no fear. He read the story of the Gunnersbury rape once more as he walked up Twyford Avenue, raising his eyes just before he reached the house. Tom Welsh was sitting outside the gate in his car. He got out when he saw Victor coming, putting on an overworn, jovial expression. "I guess you wouldn't be long. I thought I'd wait for you." It was a week since Judy had brought him here, but Victor hadn't bothered to get in touch with the aftercare people. They ought to be relieved, he thought. They must have enough on their plates. "How are things? Have you been getting on?" Victor said he was okay. He'd been getting on all right. Going up the stairs, Tom talked in a very hearty way about the weather and about the neighbourhood. This was really the best part of Acton, and these houses particularly attractive. When he saw the writing about the shit hitting the fan, he laughed rather too loudly and said he hoped that it wasn't Victor's handiwork. Victor said nothing. When they were inside, he made Tom a mug of Nescafe, thinking that later on he would have a drink. At last, after all these years, he would have a drink. Go out and buy himself a bottle of wine, maybe. "Any prospect of a job?" Tom asked. Victor shook his head. He'd forgotten about trying to get a job. It had seemed unimportant. There were so many other things to think about and handle and live with. At one time he'd felt very differently. After 1 year at the Polytechnic, they'd refused to have him back because he'd made such a mess of his first-year exams. He'd done so deliberately. The course wasn't hard, and he was sure he could have taken a good degree, but it felt like school, and he was sick of school. He wanted to work and make real money. Jobs were not a problem in the late 60s. He could take his pick. He tried the civil service, and he tried a bank, but both bored him. His father began to get heavy, making vague threats, so Victor left home and took a flat, paying rent in advance with an insurance policy which had matured when he was 21. He had a new job, selling cars. The showrooms were in North Finchley, his flat not far away in what the estate agent called Highgate Borders, and he was engaged to a girl he had met at the Polytechnic, and who was still a student there. If Pauline's temperament had been different in one respect, he sometimes thought, his whole life might have changed. None of this might have happened. He would be happily married, for didn't all the psychologists say that the children of the happily married had themselves the best chance of happiness in marriage? He would be a father, a householder, prosperous probably, respectable, content. But Pauline, what a piece of ill luck that this woman, of all women, was the one he had taken up with. He didn't want to think about her now. He could see that Tom, who was still talking about unemployment and employment, had his eyes fixed on the newspaper Victor had bought, which lay folded with the page uppermost on which the headline was Rape and Its Aftermath. "You're sure you're all right?" Tom now said. "There's nothing you're in need of." What on earth did he mean by that? What would he say if Victor answered that yes? There was plenty he was in need of. His youth back again. A place of his own, far from here. A decent job he'd enjoy doing. And another thing, too. Something that just at present he wouldn't even name to himself. His eyes strayed to the open newspaper, the word on the page, and he felt the blood go out of his face and a shiver touched the nape of his neck. Tom said, "Look, Liz said to tell you to come and have Sunday lunch with us sometime. I mean, why not this coming Sunday, Victor? Will you do that?" Victor sensed the effort behind the invitation. He had the impression Tom had had to conquer an enormous distaste for the task. Would have given a lot to forget it, but duty impelled him, social conscience forced him. Of course, Victor didn't want to go. He wouldn't go, but he couldn't think of a reason for saying no. He said yes, he'd come, while making a private decision not to turn up when the time came. After Tom had gone, Victor sat in the window looking down over the roofs of houses, over the roof of the house where his mother and father had lived, and thought about things. He was seeing the house in Solent Gardens that had brought this about, even though he had resolved not to think about the past. He couldn't help it. It was funny how people expected you to mean the things you said, he thought. Judges and juries and policemen and psychiatrists and social workers and just about everyone took it for granted you meant what you said, though they didn't mean what they said. And of everything that was ever said, Victor estimated only about half or less was meant. They'd called him a psychopath on the grounds of something he had said while he was in that bedroom with Rosemary Stanley. They took it as evidence of his cold-bloodedness and his intent to shoot Fleetwood. "I won't kill her," he had said to Fleetwood out of the window. "I'll shoot her in the back, in the lower spine." Fleetwood hadn't been at the trial to repeat that, but Rosemary Stanley had, and half a dozen witnesses. It never occurred to any of them that he hadn't meant it. In fact, he could remember exactly why he'd said it. The evening before, at home in Finchley, he'd been reading the evening paper, this same Standard, only they called it the Evening Standard in those days, and there was a piece in it about some old war hero, an ex-airman with a VC who was paralysed through a spinal injury, and there was a bit by a doctor in the article writing about what happened to you when you got shot down there in the lower spine. The words had come back to him as he talked out of the window, and he uttered them, as if by inspiration, as the nastiest thing he could think of just at that moment. It was his bad luck that when he shot at Fleetwood, never having fired a gun before, hardly knowing where and how to aim, the bullet had struck him just where Victor had threatened to shoot Rosemary Stanley. Why he had fired at all, he didn't know. He'd been so frightened, so intolerably frightened, in the worst panic of his life. Somehow, he'd always thought, if he had been able to make them understand that, they would have let him off. But they never understood. They barely stopped to listen. And yet they must all have known fear, have been frightened out of their lives, just as every day they made remarks and comments, excuses and threats, which they did not mean, even at the very time of uttering them, which stemmed from fear or boredom or simply from not knowing what else to say. Victor picked up the Standard and read the rape story again. The girl's name wasn't given, but she was 24, a hairdresser from Old Oak Road. She was recovering in hospital, her condition satisfactory. Victor wondered who it was that had attacked her in that park so near to Muriel's house, and where he was now, and what he was thinking. He turned the page, and his eyes met those of David Fleetwood, sitting in his wheelchair with his dog beside him. The story was a chatty piece. Fleetwood was writing his memoirs, in fact had written them, and this autobiography was to be published in the autumn. There was talk of a sale of television rights. The photograph showed Fleetwood sitting in the garden at the front of his house in Thaden Boys, where he'd been living for the past 3 years. Victor thought of the houses which stood in his life like landmarks. It was as if his life were a road, and as this road curved, another house of disturbing or even terrible significance came into view. His parents' house, first of all, the one whose roof he could see, then Muriel's grotesque Tudor pile, the house in Solent Gardens with its broken window and the wind blowing in to lift the curtain, now this one, Fleetwood's house in Thaden Boys. Of the four, the latter was the most attractive, part brick, part dark weatherboard, with a gable and latticed windows, a porch over an oak-studded door, a large integral garage, climbing plants, roses, perhaps, half covering the wall and now coming into leaf. The front garden was neat and well-tended, a garden pretty enough to be on a seed packet or advertising something, a hosepipe, say, or a lawnmower. Tulips filled the bed under the front windows, and some sort of blossoming tree was in flower. On a birdbath, a pigeon had obligingly perched, or perhaps the bird was made of stone. Fleetwood sat in his wheelchair, his knees covered by a rug, one hand on his Labrador's head, the other holding some sheets of manuscript. He had been interviewed by the Standard's reporter, talking about the book mostly, though not mentioning the actual incident that had caused his paralysis. Yes, he did feel pleased about the book. He would be getting a substantial advance from his publishers, but no, he wasn't planning to do any more writing in the future. Marriage? No, he didn't think so, though of course it was possible. Well, yes, he did have a girlfriend. Claire, she was called, and she had typed the manuscript for him. It was all right for some, Victor thought, folding up the paper and putting it under the bamboo table out of sight. Money, success, a woman, nice house. Fleetwood had everything. And what did he have? A furnished room, a sum of money in the bank that was very small by today's standards, an aunt whose property he just might inherit if she forgot to make a will. If she remembered to make one, he certainly wouldn't inherit anything. Muriel, anyway, though she looked 100, couldn't in fact be more than in her mid-60s, and might very likely live 20 years. His youth he had lost. It was pointless, looking at it in any other way. Those years he'd spent in prison were the best years of a man's life. That was the period of life when the best things happened to you, when you got on, and when you settled down. Alan, for instance, who was the same age, would be married now with a house of his own and flourishing business. Victor had slaved for him, sweated his guts out, getting up at all hours and often not going to bed at all. Worked for him for 5 years after he got fed up with selling Fords, and Alan hadn't even come to see him in prison. Hadn't so much as written. Pauline, he thought, would be married now to some poor devil who had perhaps adjusted to what Victor had never been able to accustom himself to. Her icy, impenetrable coldness. Well, no, not impenetrable, for he had penetrated on numerous occasions a limp, flaccid body which lay passive as blancmange while Pauline studied something on the wall with intense concentration, her mind elsewhere. Once he'd observed her counting on her fingers, doing sums. After a while, this affected him so that he wilted inside her. Pauline hadn't seemed to notice. That had been around the time when she had begun being more wakeful and active during their sexual moments, wakeful and active to the extent of chatting about what her mother had said to her on the phone that morning, and her history tutor's comments on her latest essay. Victor had got up and put his clothes on and gone out into the dark and raped a girl who was taking a shortcut home through Highgate Wood. The girl had been terrified and had shouted and fought. It wasn't like doing it to a dead sheep with a chit-chat tape playing. It was wonderful. She'd cried out, don't, oh, no. She howled like an animal. Oh, no. It took Victor some time. By then, he had committed 3 more rapes, to remember where and in what circumstances he had heard that before. When he did remember, he refused to think about it. It seemed disgusting. Blasphemous almost to think of that. By then, Pauline and he had parted. But if she had been warm and loving, greedy for sex, as he had read that women in the 70s inevitably were, if she had been all this and his wife, would he ever have attacked the 2 women on Hampstead Heath, the girls on Wandsworth Common, Wanstead Flats, in Epping Forest? That Christmas, if that different Pauline, that transformed Pauline, had been with him instead of gone 5 years before, would he have been so interested in Sydney's Luger, and a few months later stolen it? That night he slept badly, and dreamed a lot. When Tom had been gone an hour or so, he'd gone out and bought a bottle of wine and drunk it all. It was the first alcohol he had tasted for nearly 11 years. It made him drunk, which was what he wanted, though he didn't want the after-effects. His dream was an enlarging of that fantasy of his about his life as a road and the houses which appeared as he rounded the bends in it, only this time, after Muriel's house and before 62 Solent Gardens, there came into view along the road the block of flats in Finchley High Road where he had lived with Pauline, and the house in Ballard's Lane where he had been renting the top floor at the time of his arrest. He walked on, though the surface which had been smooth was now rough like a cart track, with stones and rocks in his path, like the stones in the mountainous front garden at Muriel's. The house in Solent Gardens stood alone, having been lopped off from its fellows in the terrace, and the upper window was still broken, the wind blowing in and lifting the curtain. Why, in his imagination and his dreams, did he always see it from this side, the outside, when from that aspect he had glimpsed it only once, when they had brought him out between 2 policemen, his hands manacled? The next house along the road that he came to was Fleetwood's, with its gable and its black weatherboard and climbing roses. But it wasn't the last. The last was the prison where he'd spent half his adult life, a red brick sprawl with a forest of chimneys sprouting out of its red roofs. Why did prisons always have so many chimneys, he asked himself stupidly as he woke up. It wasn't as if they were warm places, or distinguished for their cooking, or the standard of their laundry. His heart was pounding, his head throbbed, and his mouth was bone dry. Because he couldn't go back to sleep again, he got up, drank pints of water straight from the tap, his mouth over the tap, and sat by the window, looking hopelessly out over Acton. It was dawn, pearl grey and misty, the swell of traffic noise mounting already, birds starting to sing. All the gardens he could see were filled with small trees coming into leaf and flower, green and white and pink, so that a muslin-pale haze of colour lay like a thin printed cloth over earth and brick and stone. Hating the human race, Victor thought with an anger that made him clench his fists how all these householders were so mean and grudging that they wouldn't even plant a tree unless it was a fruit tree they could get something out of. Why had his life been passed in these dreary suburbs? He'd never lived anywhere interesting or different. Though there were plenty of interesting places he had passed through on his way to the airports at Heathrow and Gatwick and Luton and Stansted. Like most Londoners born north of the river, he found it hard to contemplate living south of it. The west of London he had enough of. He told himself he hated the north. Go east, then, a long way, to Epping, perhaps, or Harlow, or as far as Bishop Stortford. 3 hours later, he was once more making his way down Gunnersbury Avenue towards Muriel's house in Popesbury Drive. This was the way he had regularly driven to Heathrow. Ah, oh, he missed the use of a car. Would he ever have one again? He supposed he could go out to Epping, if he was serious about that, by coach, or bus, or all the way to the end of the Central Line. A lot more trees had come into leaf in the week since he was last here. Over the craggy outcroppings, up to Muriel's front door, the hanging plants had burst into masses of purple flowers, pink and mauve and purple and puce, so bright they hurt the eyes. Victor could hear Muriel scuffling about inside, fumbling at the door. She knew who it was. She had seen him from the window, or she'd guessed. The blue dressing gown and the mule she wore were the same, and so was the smell of camphor, but the pink snood with which she had covered her hair had been changed for a brown one. She peered suspiciously out at him, grudgingly easing the door open, widening inch by inch the gap between door and door frame until it was just wide enough for Victor to pass through. "What do you want this time?" He might have been some importunate beggar, always bothering her for money or meals, rather than a nephew whom she had seen only twice in 10 years. Needless to say, Muriel hadn't been to see him in prison either. If she wouldn't set foot outside for her husband's funeral, she'd hardly have gone prison visiting. Yet he had never done her any harm. He couldn't call taking that gun harming her, and if the police had come here questioning her about it and searching the place, no one had blamed her. No one had put her away for 10 years. He followed her into the living room, explaining about Jupp and how he would be coming to look at the furniture 2 weeks from today. The room was stuffy with a fine fug built up. A large electric fire with two elements was switched on. Muriel had made herself a cosy haven or enclave in front of this fire, an island in the sea of magazines. There was the armchair in which she had been sitting with two cushions in the back of it and a pillow in a dirty white pillowcase, a plaid rug over one arm. A footstool that looked like a hassock pinched out of a church, a table on each side of it, one with a library book on it, a pair of glasses and a bottle of aspirins, the other containing a pile of magazines, a ballpoint pen and a pair of scissors. Instead of returning to her chair, Muriel stood there, hesitantly, looking at him with a truculent stare. From a distant part of the house, a whistle started up and rose to a scream. Of course, Victor knew quite well what this must be, or he knew within a split second. At the start of it, though, he gave a slight jump, and for some reason this brought a grin to Muriel's face. "I was going to make myself a coffee," she said. Victor followed her down the passage to the kitchen. Muriel shuffled along, the belt of her dressing gown trailing behind her. For some reason she never fastened the belt, but preferred to hold the sides of the dressing gown together with her left hand. The kettle was jumping about on the gas and squealing. Muriel was very slow. She put a spoonful of instant coffee into each cup, calculating that they contained precisely the same amount by studying the individual grains and tipping an extra grain off the top of the second one with a knife. Victor's nerves couldn't stand the bouncing and squealing, and he pushed past her to lift the kettle off the gas. She looked at him in resentful surprise. She opened the fridge and removed a small carton of double cream. This went onto a round tray with one of the cups of coffee, a sugar basin, and two biscuits on a plate. The biscuits were of the kind made for children, called iced bears, shaped like teddy bears with coloured sugar on them. Onto a second, smaller tray, Muriel put the other cup of coffee and pushed it across the table to Victor. He could hardly believe his eyes. The tray with the cream and biscuits she meant exclusively for herself. She was hugging it to her with her hands round its rim. He didn't even merit a teaspoon. But what was the use of arguing with her? He reached across the table for the sugar, climbing over her hands, so to speak, in order to do so, like someone scaling a fence that surrounds a forbidden park. Taking his cup, he went out into the garage to have another look at the furniture. It was wonderful how material, mere pieces of coloured fabric, could awaken so much in the memory. Covering a bedstead and some sort of chest were the curtains which had hung at his own bedroom windows when he was a boy. They must have been of very good quality to have lasted so long. A pattern of bluish-green and red blocks and a black-and-white background, post-war and early 50s fashion. He could clearly remember lying in bed and looking at that pattern, the sunlight shining through and making them transparent, or else they'd be opaque when there was darkness outside. He would lie there, waiting for his mother to come upstairs and tuck him in and kiss him good night. Sometimes, before he could read, he hoped for a story as well. She always promised to come, but she seldom did. She was with his father, distracted by his father's greater glamour, stronger desirability. The neglect wasn't bad enough to make him cry, though, and he would fall asleep with the last thing printed on his retina, those curtains patterned in bluish-green and red blocks on a black-and-white background. Perhaps he shouldn't let Jupp have all this furniture. If he was going to find himself somewhere to live in Epping, he might need it. Suddenly, Victor knew he wouldn't be able to live with the furniture which had surrounded him when he was a boy. It was painful even to look at it. The curtain patterns, for some reason, were the worst, but the beds were bad too, and that brown velvet settee. The only thing he decided he felt all right about was his father's wheelchair, and that was perhaps because he hadn't been there when his father had got it, and he had never seen his father using it. Victor drank his coffee and covered up the bed and chest again, and asked himself why he was suddenly taking it for granted that he was going to live in Epping. Surely he hadn't decided on that. He'd never really been to Epping, just passed through on his way to Stansted, and once, of course, stopped off in the forest near a pub called, he thought, the Robin Hood. And there, a good quarter of a mile from the road, in a glade of bracken and birch trees, he'd come upon a woman walking alone. Not young or pretty or in any way attractive to him, but a woman. Alone. Victor went back into the kitchen. His aunt had gone. He found her back in her armchair in front of the electric fire, in the close, camphor-smelling fog, cutting a piece out of a sheet of newsprint with her scissors.
"I've got something to show you," she said.
"No, thanks. I know what it is." Out of the corner of his eye, he'd seen the photographed corner of Fleetwood's house, a section of gable, an inch of chimney stack. She took no notice but went on cutting, holding the paper and the scissors right up close to her nose.
"He's writing a book," she said. "It's going to be all about his past life."
"I know," said Victor. "I've seen the paper. You're not telling me anything I don't know."
"You'll be in it."
He felt anger beginning to mount again, hot liquid rising in the vessel of his body.
"There's bound to be a long bit in it about you, with pictures."
She laid the scissors down, folded the cut piece of paper in two. Her face was raised up towards his, the sagging flesh of her neck hanging in a double pleat from her chin.
"It's only what you deserve," she said.
Victor had read somewhere that walking or any vigorous exercise frees the body of tensions and calms anger. He didn't find this to be true in his own case. Making his way back to Gunnersbury Avenue, he was filled with murderous rage, to the brim now. The lack of understanding maddened him, not just in his aunt, in everyone. All those people who couldn't see why things happened, how things could happen to you almost without your being aware of them, and then you were punished forever. And even then, they said it wasn't enough. he would be in Fleetwood's book. Victor wasn't much of a reader. He'd always preferred films and television. But if he ever read anything, it was biography and memoirs. If Fleetwood were to write a book about his life, indeed had done so, Victor would be in it, with a chapter to himself, probably, with photographs of himself. While his trial was going on, newspapers had used a studio portrait of himself taken at his mother's request at the time of his 21st birthday. His mother wouldn't have given it to a reporter, so Muriel must have done. Another photograph was the one of him being brought out of 62 Solent Gardens between two policemen. Probably both these would be in Fleetwood's book, unless he could stop it by some legal means, though he didn't know how to go about this, and was afraid anyway that it might cost a lot of money. Could Fleetwood say what he liked about him in the book, and have no redress? No doubt Fleetwood would call him a psychopath, and those words he had shouted out of the window would be quoted again. "I'll shoot her in the back, in the lower spine." When she had stood in the witness box and repeated those words, Rosemary Stanley had cried. She had stumbled over the words and begun to weep. A very effective method, Victor had thought, of getting all the sympathy of the court, as if she didn't have enough already. That would doubtless be in Fleetwood's book, even though he wasn't at the trial. And Fleetwood's book was going to be on sale everywhere, in paperback as well, turned into a film for television. The idea made Victor feel sick. As soon as he was back in his room, he took the Standard from the rack under the bamboo coffee table in order to read the article again, to learn from it what he could. But he had left the paper folded so that the Gunnersbury Park rape story was uppermost, and a line caught his eye, a kind of subheading in quotation marks. "Rape is not a sexual act, but an act of aggression." Some psychiatrist had said it. He was wondering what it meant, how screwing a girl could be anything but sexual, when the front doorbell rang. Victor had heard that bell ring before, usually in the evening when one of the other tenants had gone to answer it. Whoever it was, it couldn't be for him, and he wasn't going to answer it now. The bell rang again. Victor heard footsteps and then voices. Someone had opened the front door, and this surprised him, very slightly alarmed him, for he had been certain that there was no one in the house. Footsteps started up the stairs. He knew they would go past his door and on up. They had to. There was no one who could possibly want him. There were at least two people coming upstairs. The knocking on his door was like thunder, a kind of thunder that makes you jump because it is preceded by no warning flash of lightning. Victor's calm, his sanity, his euphoria vanished, and he felt panic like a mass of tingling wires. He opened the door, aware of how vulnerable, how helpless he must look. Outside stood a woman in a hat and two men in the kind of leisure wear the police thought disguised them. Victor knew the woman must be Mrs. Griffiths, his landlady. He knew it from the expression on her face, forbearing, patient, virtuous yet mildly disapproving, the kind of look worn by someone who is socially conscientious enough to take ex-convicts into her house, along with all the inevitable consequences. "CID," said the older man, the one in the heather mixture tweed jacket. "Can we have a word, Vic?" Chapter 6. No one ever called him that. Vic. He hated it. It sounded like the stuff his mother rubbed on his chest when he was a child. What right had they to call him by his Christian name anyway? He heard the younger one, the one in the distressed leather jacket, say, "Thanks very much, Mrs. Griffiths. Sorry to bother you." They didn't call her Betty or Lily or whatever her name was. But he had been in prison, of course, and therefore forfeited his human dignity, his right to respect, for ever and ever. They came in, and distressed leather shut the door. Heather Mixture said, "Nice little place you've got here." Victor said nothing. The palms of his hands tingled. He felt a creeping in his shoulders, as if an insect was crawling across his back. He sat down. They didn't. "Don't suppose you need to go out much. Haven't got a job, have you?" Replying to this with a shake of his head, Victor wondered if he would be able to find a voice. His throat had closed. He would have liked to ask what they wanted, rather than endure all this facetious preamble, but he didn't dare experiment with speech. They were both staring at him, but at least distressed Leather had sat down. "Still, you've been out today. Need a breath of fresh air sometimes, no doubt. We're having a nice spring, aren't we? Off and away after a bad summer. But you wouldn't know about that, really, would you? Having been, what should we say, out of circulation at the time? Most people in your situation, Vic, find going out a bit of an ordeal at first. But it hasn't taken you that way, am I right?" Victor lifted his crawling shoulders. "No, it hasn't taken you that way," repeated Heather Mixture. "You've been out, you've faced the world. How many times have you been out, would you reckon? Every day? Every other day? Twice a day? How about last Monday, for instance? Did you go out then?" His voice came, less than a voice, but better than a croak. "Why do you want to know?" Even as he spoke, he knew. Nonetheless, it was a horrible shock to him. On Monday night, a girl had been raped in Gunnersbury Park. He'd read about it in the Standard. He'd bought the Standard and read about it on his way back from Jupp's. He hadn't been to prison for rape. He had been to prison for shooting David Fleetwood. But once he'd been convicted, before sentence was passed, he'd asked through his counsel, on his counsel's advice, for two cases of rape to be taken into consideration. This had been done expediently in case the police tried to charge him with these offences once he had served his sentence. Victor's counsel was not to know that those two instances were not the only rapes Victor had committed. He hadn't wanted to mention them at all. He hadn't wanted to bring it, his nature, out into the open. But he had. He had yielded to persuasion. And now the police knew. He must be on a file somewhere. A file on one of these computers which had taken over the world while he was inside. Victor didn't want to think now of the implications of that. "Well, let's play it this way," said Heather Mixture. "You answer my question first. How about that?" "I want to see my aunt." Heather Mixture's facial muscles didn't move, but a grin twitched at distressed Leather's mouth. "And where might this lady live?"
"Gunnersbury."
They went stiff and still for a moment.
"As to your question, Vic, I think we can forget about that, don't you? You know very well what we're on about. You know what you are, and we know. It would save a lot of time and trouble if we all got in the car and went down to the police station."
They wanted to carry out some tests. Heather Mixture had all sorts of amusing euphemisms for being in prison, bringing them out one after another, for the sake of seeing Victor's discomfiture, perhaps, and distressed Leather's twitching, sycophantic mouth. At first, Victor refused, saying he wanted his lawyer. The name of the solicitor who had briefed counsel for him nearly 11 years ago he still remembered, but not the man's office address or phone number. Nor did he have a 5 or 10 pence piece for the phone. Heather Mixture said he could have his solicitor, no problem, easiest thing out. He could phone him from the police station. At that, Victor gave in because he thought they would probably eventually make him go to the police station, though how he didn't know. The girl's name was Susan Davies. She was in hospital and would be there for a long time. She had described her attacker as being between 25 and 35, dark-haired, of medium height. They told him all that. When Victor pointed out that he was 38, Heather Mixture said most people liked being taken for younger than they were, and anyway, you didn't age so fast when you were sheltered from the world, endurance vile. They told Victor they would like to do a blood test. Victor said he wanted his lawyer. "Nothing easier," said a detective inspector Victor hadn't seen before. But when he asked for a phone directory, the detective inspector said he couldn't quite lay hands on one just at that moment, and why didn't Victor go over to the lab with Sergeant Latimer, distressed Leather, and have his blood tested while he looked for the phone book? Of course, Victor went. He was considerably unnerved. Latimer explained something to him he hadn't known before. Perhaps it wasn't generally known, or hadn't even been discovered before he went to prison. This was that some men are what are called secretors. That is, their blood group can be detected from their semen and other body fluids. There was no knowing whether or not Victor was a secretor without carrying out tests. Victor now saw that it was very much in his own interest to have the tests done. He stopped worrying about finding a solicitor. All he wanted was to get out of there and get home exonerated. He hadn't raped Susan Davies, but he could already see that circumstantially he wasn't going to be able to prove he hadn't been in Gunsbury Park at the relevant time. There were no witnesses he could produce that he had been at home, and his Aunt Muriel, if it was imaginable that anyone could get any sense out of her, could only say that he'd been with her for a couple of hours in the afternoon. The blood test would prove it. 3/4 of all people were secretors, Latimer said. They kept him hanging about there until they got the results of the tests. Nothing more was said about a telephone directory, and Victor didn't mention it. It was early evening, and they'd brought him a hamburger and a cup of tea before they told him the results. Well, they didn't exactly tell him. They wouldn't. They merely said he could go home. They wouldn't want to be seeing him again. Like Judy and Tom, only more so, they treated him as if he was subhuman, some intelligent. Victor said he supposed he must be a secretor, then. That's right, the detective inspector said. What blood group was he? Victor asked, not expecting an answer, expecting to be told this was a police station, if he didn't mind, not a Harley Street consulting room. But the inspector told him, laconically, dismissively, it appeared that he was B positive. Did that mean anything to him? Victor left. On the way home, he went into a wine shop and bought a 1/4 bottle of whiskey and 20 cigarettes. Soon after he went to prison, he had stopped smoking, though it was possible to smoke in there at certain prescribed times. But he had stopped. Now he felt he needed something strong and comforting to drink. At least he hadn't succumbed to panic. He hadn't fallen into raving madness and tried to grab, hit, or shake them. He congratulated himself on that. The cigarettes and the scotch would take care of this shaking which had taken over his hands, and sometimes his knees, too, from the moment he'd left the police station. He let himself into the house. Mrs. Griffiths, in hat, coat, and gloves, was in the hall, talking to a young woman Victor had never seen before. The young woman looked away. Mrs. Griffiths gave him a tight smile, which Victor knew meant it was one thing having ex-convicts in one's house, but only if they had turned over a new leaf. It was 7 years since he had smoked a cigarette. The first puff made his gorge rise and he vomited into the sink. He sat down on the bed, shivering. Things suddenly presented themselves to him with an awful clarity. While it had obviously been in his interest to have those tests done at that particular point in time, taking the long view, it was a disaster. They had found out his blood group. They had found he was a secretor, and on top of that was the misfortune that he belonged to a rare blood group. Victor remembered incongruously an occasion years and years ago watching a television show in which the comedian Tony Hancock appeared in a sketch about blood groups. The point was that he turned out to have the rarest known group, AB negative. B positive, which was Victor's group, wasn't as rare as that, but still only 6% of the population belonged to it. Every time there was an attack on a girl in West London, in the whole of London, the home counties come to that, and there was evidence that the perpetrator was a B secretor, they would come to him. But that was one thing. That could be borne, since there would be few cases. Well, what if he himself were the perpetrator? Victor knew the time would come when he would want to assault a girl again. There was a part of him which said he wouldn't, that he would struggle for his own sake to avoid this, but at the same time he knew that the struggle couldn't be wholly effective. He poured some of the whiskey into one of Mrs. Griffith's thick, moulded glasses, the kind that are given away with a sale of more than 30 litres of petrol. There was no question of vomiting that up. It warmed him and swam into his head. If the time came when he attacked a girl, when the time came, they would do whatever you did do to a computer. Type it like a typewriter, probably, and up would come a printout. Victor Jenner, 38, 46 Tollishunt Avenue, Acton, W5, secretor, blood group, B pos. And it would. It must happen every time, only there wouldn't be every time. There would be the once and the last, for after that he would be in jail for the rest of his life. He could imagine the judge calling him a dangerous animal, would have to be locked up for the safety of the community, a wild beast who, unless permanently restrained, would indiscriminately ravish women and murder men. The thing was that he wasn't really like that at all, Victor thought. He was frightened and panicky and alone. He would have liked help, but he didn't know where to get it, certainly not from Tom or Judy, who would offer evening classes and community service. How different must be the life of David Fleetwood, whose fault all this was. Fleetwood was safe, secure, housed, pensioned. His sexual problems had been taken care of in the soundest, most final way. Victor, sitting on his bed drinking whiskey in the darkening room, thought he wouldn't mind that solution to his own dilemma. Then the desire, the temptation, the uncontrollable urge would be gone forever. And most of all, Fleetwood had respect. Everyone respected him, positively worshipped and honoured him. If he had had to go to a police station for tests, they would probably have called him Sir. It was ironical, really. Fleetwood had brought all this about by his obtuseness, yet it was he who had all the glory and Victor who got all the stick, on and on, for years. Perhaps Fleetwood had done it on purpose, Victor thought. Human behaviour was incomprehensible, everyone knew that. Perhaps Fleetwood had got himself shot on purpose, knowing he would get looked after for life and that people adored a crippled hero. Victor walked along Twyford Avenue towards the High Street. He had passed two dreadful nights and a bad day. Both nights he'd wakened up with his heart racing and his body all a prickle. The first time he had lain there weeping, then turning his face into the pillow to muffle the screams he couldn't otherwise control. In the morning he'd met a fellow tenant on the landing, a man who had asked him if he'd heard anything in the night, someone crying, for instance, and a noise like bedsprings repetitively jerked. Victor muttered that he'd heard nothing. Most of the day he had slept, finding it easy to sleep, escaping, thankfully, into sleep as a respite from life. But that night the panic came upon him with redoubled force, enclosing him in its straitjacket way, convulsing his limbs with a kind of spasticity, so that he could not lie still but had to jump out of bed and seize and manhandle the nearest object. This happened to be the cane chair, which he found himself grasping and pounding up, down, first against the wall and then on the floor. His teeth were clenched, and he could hear himself make a kind of growling sound. One of the legs split off the chair and hung by a strand of raffia. Spent and gasping, Victor flung himself onto the bed. Almost immediately someone knocked on his door. Victor took no notice. His heart was beating so hard that it hurt him with its pumping, as if it would beat its way out through his chest wall. Whoever had knocked at the door shouted that they wanted to know what the hell was going on. Victor staggered to the door, put his mouth close to it, and whispered that it was nothing. It was over. "For Christ's sake," said the voice. Victor had no more sleep. He got up very early and went out onto the landing with a bar of soap and a pot scourer and erased the writing on the wall. There was no point in it any more. It had happened. The shit had hit the fan. He went to the library to see what he could read up about blood grouping. There was quite a lot of literature about it. Victor knew he was an intelligent person. Someone had measured his IQ for him when he was at college, and it had come out at 130. And usually able to grasp scientific data, but blood grouping was too much for him. It was too complicated and abstruse for him to follow. What he did gather was that the ABO system had been discovered as far back as 1900, but that since then a dozen or so other systems had been found, including the rhesus one, and all these could be tested for, thus fining down even further the possibilities of whose blood was whose. There was the MNS system, the Lutheran, the Kell, the YT, and the Domrock. Why, it looked as if the time would come when everybody's blood group would turn out to be different from everybody else's. But later he began to think about it more rationally. He'd never been charged with rape, and rape had never been proved against him. Besides that, he intended never to attack a woman again. If he could survive 10 years in prison without attacking a woman, surely he could survive the rest of his life. Rape is not a sexual act, but an act of aggression, the newspaper had told him. Was it anger, then, that made him attack women? And if he could otherwise handle his anger, would that make him stop wanting to attack them?